Hello, my name's Lynn. I'm an alcoholic. Can y'all hear me okay? I'm blasting you out here. Thank you, Billy, for asking me to speak. It is always a privilege to do something for AA, and I thank you all for being here tonight. I thank AA for being here for people like me. You know, I am one of those folks who is highly confused about whether or not I'm an alcoholic. You know, when I first tried alcohol as a little kid, I grew up in a family where my family's from Europe, so giving kids alcohol wasn't a big deal. I remember, you know, Mom would serve wine at Christmas and Easter, and we were Eastern Orthodox, so what was really cool is we got to celebrate two Christmases because we had to be kind of like the people around us, just a little. And then we had two Christmases and two Easters, and you know, I remember having a little bit of red wine in my Bugs Bunny glass, and you know, I didn't have to go empty the liquor cabinet after that. So the reason I say that is one of my areas of confusion, even to this day at times when my mind plays tricks on me, is I used to hear things when I first landed in the rooms after my when I first thought I would try to get sober. I heard, well, I always drank to get drunk, and I always would hear something, some form of that. But, you know, I didn't have that craving as a little kid when I drank a little wine at Christmas. You know, I wasn't a wild kid, not really. I mean, maybe a typical teenager, I guess. You know, we had a rebellious streak at times. But, I wasn't really part of the wild crowd. Wasn't into drugs. I guess God spared me from that. I'm glad I didn't go there for whatever reason. You know, in high school, a few times I got together with a boyfriend who, we used to wax his truck. I'm from Botetourt County. Does anybody know that area? It's really pretty. It's kind of like, it looks like this place, actually. It's near Roanoke, Virginia. And for excitement in Botetourt County, we would get together on Sunday, have lunch with the family, and wax his truck, and maybe share a six-pack. And I know that sounds horrifically lame, but at that point in time, you know, I wasn't drinking to get drunk. My next-door neighbor, Allison, she was like my older sister. All of her brothers and sister were gone, and Mom and Dad, I was like the youngest. Mom and Dad tried one more time to have a boy, and they blew it again after my sisters grew up and went to high school. So they're like moms to me. It's great having four moms, but I remember Allison and me talking about getting the buzz, and we used to have these philosophical conversations in high school, like, you know, those people who come from strict families, they're the ones that are going to have the problem because, you know, they're under the thumb, they're the ones that are going to want to rebel. And I remember, it's just weird, I don't know why that came up, because my parents weren't strict in that way. I mean, we were kind of the Holly and Lily Christians. We went to church, and we felt like it. So I didn't grow up with a lot of structure. And guess what? I'm still not structured, but it's funny. But I end up becoming an alcoholic. So it isn't structure or lack of structure that makes you an alcoholic. You know, around 4 years sober, there are a couple of incidents that I have now come to believe that may have been the first sign that I may have had a problem with alcohol. You know, aside from the, you know, couple six packs and maybe a couple times getting drunk in high school. I'm one of these people who's very nervous. I'm squirrels on amphetamines by nature. I'm scared of people. And I do remember those handful of times having beer and just calming down. And people actually, I don't know, they didn't mind hanging around me. I just relaxed and people enjoyed being around me after I drank. You know, I guess that's a clue. I don't know. But, you know, one thing, I wasn't the student. I wasn't the beauty queen. I wasn't, you know, the group I hung out with were the gymnasts, okay, you know, and I remember making it to state 1 year. That was a big deal for a little rinky-dink AA high school in Botetourt County. I don't know, I got lucky. The star gymnast fell off the beam or something, so I got her place and got to go to state that year, and we were going to celebrate, and I remember going to Connie's house. You know, it's nerve-wracking dancing on a little thin beam in this little leotard, you know, I mean, in high school, you know, you're self-conscious at that age, and I remember going to Connie's house, Rob and Connie, Robin's new boyfriend, Robbie, all these are names, and we were just going to relax, and she had this fully stocked bar, the parents were gone, and I tried grain for the first time. I guess you younger folks call it Everclear, we called it grain way back when, and I thought I would try it, because, you know, usually I just have wine or beer. And I think I may have tried some apricot brandy. My dad was an alcoholic, and he had little stashes of apricot brandy in little brown bags in the drawers. And I remember Alice and me finding all 20 of them, and with little bits left, and we were both trying it. But anyway, back to the gymnastics story. We're home. The meet was done. I was relaxing now, and I tried grain for the first time. And I remember drinking a little bit, and it's like it evaporated as soon as you drank it. And I figured, well, okay, if I'm going to get any of this in me, I'm going to have to drink it fast. And this is straight up no frou-frou mixed drink stuff. I drank it, and I was there. Wham, you know, burns a hole in your esophagus, but I liked being there. You know, it's like you're at one with the universe. You know, it's like I'm not in pain in my own skin anymore, you know, for a few minutes. And, you know, the problem with that feeling is it goes away unless you keep drinking. And so, you know, I'm trying out Connie's free floater waterbed. Nothing funny happened that night. I mean, we're just good friends. And I remember drinking the grain and trying the free floater waterbed. Next thing I know, I'm in the bathroom puking my guts out. And people after a couple of hours of me, what seemed like a couple of hours after dry heaving and dying and begging God to kill me, they checked on me and believed me. They wished they hadn't, because by the time they got to the doorway, it's like, man, it stinks in here. So much for the teenager looking good in front of the guys. But I just remember thinking, I'm never drinking that again. And I'll tell you the truth, even though I'm an alcoholic, I did not touch grain after that experience. It was painful. And, you know, I walked a straight line home sideways, and Mom tucked me in bed. She was used to my alcoholic dad. She didn't chastise me or anything. She just put me in bed, you know. I know she had to have smelled me, you know. It's funny because my bipolar mom was sometimes the most understanding person. But I remember Connie telling me later on, you drank everything in that bottle except for this much, and that was straight grain. And this is the wimpy little six-pack, you know, share a six-pack person. So something changed. I guess in a sense I was a binge drinker for a while because, you know, my next-door neighbor, Allison, nice Christian family. I think this is just my higher power doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. I'm an image manager, and I want you to like me, and Allison shook her finger at me because, you know, by then I was smoking a little bit and I was drinking. I mean, I don't know. I don't know why. Then she just pointed out what a hypocrite I am. And, you know, we alcoholics are not going to be called hypocrites. So at that point in time in my life, I ixnayed what I was doing. It wasn't easy to quit smoking. I'd only smoked for a few months. And, I remember I just left the alcohol alone because it was important to me how her family saw me. Even though we're the Holly and Lily Christians, they kind of got me into the Baptist church and just good folks, you know, good people, people that were kind to me. And then because I wanted them to like me, I acted a certain way. And I left it alone for a couple of years. And then my senior year, I got drunk once. I remember sliding backwards on a couch and, you know, actually I was meeting a friend I wanted to meet for a couple of years, and funny, they just left me alone. It's like, you know, I must have really made a fool of myself that night. I have these little flashes of memory. I wasn't really a blackout drinker per se. I was a passer outer at home. I was kitchen drunk as opposed to being a mobile drunk. So it took me a long time and a lot of confusion because I heard your exciting stories. I thought, you're the real drunks. You're the exciting people. You could never accept me into this fellowship because I'm boring. But I'm here to prove to you it's possible to be boring and be a drunk. You know, Marcy really helped me with that. One of my sister's sponsees, you know, when I first came in, I would hear things. And one thing Marcy straightened me out on is what happened when you took the first drink? Can you predict every single time what would happen to you when you picked up that drink? I mean, I thought because some nights I could have to, well, maybe I'm not a real alcoholic. I really do have control of this thing. But you know what? Towards the end, I really couldn't predict what would happen because the physical craving definitely did take a hold. I'm not going to go through the whole drunk log, but just give you a snippet of it. You know, I ended up working in a hospital. I'm a nurse like Lynn. I could tell those announcements must have had, Lynn had that input about the pacemaker. Don't turn those off. We don't want to practice our CPR ACLS skills. But I remember just going to the hospital and just being anxious. You know, I never fit. I never fit wherever, whether it was school, whether it was church, whether it was work, whatever. I never fit in. I probably needed to drink more in college. I was not the wild college drinker. You know, because another friend shook his finger at me, another guy that knew of my Christian beliefs, and I didn't want to look bad to him, so I left it alone as long as he was watching. And as a matter of fact, it's just ironic, because I ended up hanging out with the charismatics in college. You know, they believed Jesus turned the water to grape juice, not wine, so, you know, I didn't want to drink in front of them and tick them off and think, I didn't want them to think I didn't have the Holy Spirit or something, so I'm image managed. I met my husband, second year of college, not an alcoholic. We were married 22 years, and he's not even Al-Anon. It took me a while to realize he's not an Al-Anon. He's just a great guy, you know. He's, I don't know why he sticks with me, but when I first met Randy at VCU in Richmond, I remember seeing him drinking a beer at a party, and I'm like, you're a Christian, and you drink. I mean, at this point, I was even a teetotaler for a while because, you know, I'm trying to please my charismatic friends, and I'm not proselytizing anybody, by the way. This is just my story. As warped as it is, but I remember shaking my finger at Randy and saying, you're a Christian and you drink. I mean, it's just so ironic. And then once I changed my philosophy of drinking, I bypassed him. That's the funny thing about all this. I hung out with him, got to know his pastor. They would have a beer with their hamburger at a cookout. They didn't rip up the neighborhood. And I thought, well, you know, these are good folks, and they're having a beer. Maybe it's okay. Maybe the charismatics were wrong, which I kind of liked that idea because I really did want to drink all the time that I wasn't drinking. And, you know, at first, again, I didn't look like, you know, the wild person who's driving drunk. You know, I would have a couple of those wimpy Bartles and James wine coolers. And, you know, after a while we're buying, it used to be called Price Club. I don't know if you guys shop at Sam's or what is it now? It's called Costco. We used to get the wine. We had to always save money because I'm a nurse. He's a violin teacher. We're not rich. So we always bought things in bulk, right? And we would get that big old Gallo, what was it, like a gallon jug of Gallo back then? This is before. For the wine that came in the bag and the box, but, you know, we would cook with it a lot, you know, and, you know, you put a half a cup of wine in the chicken and drink the rest of it, why bother the glass, because, you know, I mean, you got to wash the glass, and it takes too much time to keep pouring it, you know, it's a lot of work, but I remember going to, for a short while, I was in the reserves, and I had a chance to go to Mexico and pick up some of that tequila, you know, with the worm in it. I don't know if you've ever had that. When you open it, it smells disgusting, like, I don't know, the vacuum cleaner bag that's been used, way overused, and it was disgusting. Now, it didn't stop me from drinking it because, of course, you know, I spent the money on it, and I was going to make 7 and 7s out of it. I don't know. I'd make different drinks out of them, and I wasn't a bartender, you can tell, but I don't care. I drank it. I mixed it with whatever I had in the house, or sometimes I drank it a little straight, except with the worm in there, it smelled bad. But I remember drinking after my 12-hour night shifts. You know, it was like I thought, okay, I've got to be back at work at 7. I couldn't get myself calmed down so that I could just sleep and be ready to work the next night. And gosh knows, I'm scared to be working without adequate sleep. And, you know, because, you know, med errors, ICU, I mean, I just remember just fear-driven. I'm one of these absolutely crazy fear-driven people. And so I guess drinking was one of the ways I tried to manage my fear. I mean, praying was great, but alcohol took care of my fear. You know, that's how I'm wired. And after a while, you know, I used to think it was the night shift coffee that ripped a hole in my stomach. You know, my stomach was uncomfortable there towards the end before I switched to beer. You know, I thought it was the night shift coffee, but it was probably the tequila and the harder stuff I was drinking. And wine by then was giving me headaches, so I don't know. I got away from the Michelob and Killian's, and I switched to Bud. That was like my drink of choice. You know, I was weighing about 150 pounds bloated out on beer because by the end I was drinking about a case a night, you know. The case I bought, I thought, well, maybe I'll switch to the day shift, you know, working the PACU, the recovery room, instead of the night shift in the ICU. And then I could drink a little after work and make dinner and, you know, that six-pack turned into 12-pack turned into a case, which the cases I was buying, and I'm thinking, okay, well, this is going to last a week or two. And it wasn't lasting a week or two. It was lasting a night or two. You know, because I'm one of these people, I think this is where the physical craving really kicked in, kind of like that night when I was having that grain. It was like, it just felt good to always have a beer in your hand. I was getting things done around the house. You know, that's how I got things done, you know, big projects especially, because we lived in this $60,000 you know, fixer-upper house from the 1950s. And I'm thinking of my sister in the West End who has the nice house. She could work or not work. You know, I'm one of these people that has a lot of resentment against family. You know, I was resentful against Mom. We're trying to take care of her in her last year of life. And isn't that sick how I think of that instead of what a privilege it is to think of my mom in her last year? But I had a lot of anger towards family. I'm the perpetual victim, and I get a lot of mileage and power out of that. And today, 9 years sober, I can fall into that thinking so quickly. I don't know if any of you have ever done this. I am so toxic. I can be toxic and not even realize I'm toxic until everybody's like, you know, they're like, stay away from me. And I realize I haven't 10th stepped in a while. And then at that point, I have to 4th step and then and talk to Val and get honest, you know. But, you know, this, I'd driven my family away. I mean, they came around, but they avoided me as much as they could. I remember seeing Barbara come up the sidewalk because we're storing Grandma's stuff in Mom's house. We end up moving in my mom's house, that the fixer-upper, and I remember just seeing Barbara come up the sidewalk. I'd have to get beer out and drink before she came because I couldn't stand her. Really, what it was, I couldn't stand myself, you know? I couldn't stand myself around her because I don't know how to treat people, you know, when I'm fear-driven and a victim, you know, because all these people around me aren't acting right, you know. Drinking makes it a little easier, right? But that's where I was, really close to my bottom. Close to my bottom, I don't think I remember her coming around a lot. I was just coming home from work and drinking and making dinner. And I remember one night, I didn't, you know, no DUIs, nothing like that, but this one I consider a close one. My little 2.5-year-old had learned how to turn the doorknob. You remember when your kid learned how to open the door, or your grandkid learned how to open the door? That's a scary thing. And we're on a busy street. Some of you know Richmond. Huguenot Road is like a main drag. And I remember one night I'm in there cooking with, you know, the beer and putzing around the house, and I hear this knock on the door. And I go answer the door thinking, who's visiting us now? Because by now I've driven everybody away. And this lady was holding my son's hand. And he was out by the mailbox. He could have been road meat, you know. I heard this lady's story the other night, Angela, and she said she used to at least get a babysitter when she got schnocked up a man. I didn't even, you know, I just didn't think about it. I didn't intend to get drunk. I was not drinking to get drunk. I know some people do that. I just know that the alcohol made me feel good, and I kept drinking, you know. And as a matter of fact, when my husband asked me the question, and which I thought was so ironic, I had that little flashback to the finger-shaking time, and we're standing in the kitchen. I was in my fog, but I had maybe a few seconds of clarity, and I remember Randy asking me about my drinking. And there was part of me thinking, you know, back here, maybe I'm like my dad, the alcoholic. But then I thought, well, I stay home and drink. I'm kind of responsible. Never mind, my son almost was road meat, but... So I started hiding it. What does any good alcoholic do? You know, I'm not about to give up something that was my solution that made me feel good and helped me stay glued together. It was my solution at that point, and I wasn't about to give it up. And I thought I was being responsible because I wasn't a mobile drunk. And so I had little stashes everywhere, you know, behind the laundry detergent. We had a backyard that was so overgrown that we even found one of those antique iron wheelbarrows. I mean, Mom's house was overgrown. We didn't have time to take care of it in our house. And I remember we're clearing trees. I used to like to go out there and clear trees and have stashes of beer everywhere. And I remember stumbling around the yard. And Randy, it's funny because Randy at day said, man, you stink. It's funny. People tell you that a lot when you drink. But I remember my neighbors one time seeing me stumbling in the driveway. Are you okay? You know, so nothing exciting, but just little hints like that. And I remember seeing a counselor because by now I've driven everybody away and I'm the perpetual unending victim. And I just remember being scared about some things at work and talking to her. And she said, well, you know what? I'm not going to test you or treat you until you go to an IOP, an intensive outpatient program. And I don't know, at that point I was just so, I couldn't get momentum going to die or live. I just couldn't, and I was beat. So I went to an IOP. And because I was beginning to think, you know, maybe I do have a problem. So I jumped through the little IOP hoops. I went to my meetings because I didn't want to get in trouble. And really, I wanted to talk to this counselor. And they sent me to AA. I know some people have issues with treatment facilities. But, you know, I'll hand it to them. At least they introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous. We had to go twice a week in addition to our three meetings. But, you know, I can manage for a while. I can pull it together, plans and designs to look somewhat good enough to keep you off my back. I wouldn't even say I looked good. I was just barely compliant enough to keep you off my back. I stayed dry for about a year and a half in an IOP and doing the little AA meetings. But I ended up drinking again. I was giving somebody a ride home from a meeting, and they introduced me to Magnum, you know, 6% alcohol. So it's a little bit better than Bud. You get more bang for your buck. And you have to drink them cold, though. They're disgusting when you're they're hot hidden behind a shed. But I remember drinking for a while, but, and the misery was right there. I was miserable the whole time, but I don't know. I guess the misery just came to a head. And like I said a minute ago, I couldn't live and I couldn't die. I didn't really want to die. I really did love my family, but I could not pull it together to love them and to just live life on life's terms. I just couldn't do it. You know, I was a shell of a person walking around. You know, I felt half dead, even though I was a person of faith. I mean, I just, you know, by that I'm shaking my fist at God, you know. And I just remember being completely miserable. And I guess for me that was my emotional and spiritual bottom. And I just didn't, I guess I had, you know, a moment enough of clarity to go pick up that. I had a little meeting schedule in Richmond. We call them the Wearing Winds. That's our little meeting schedule. And I couldn't go to the north side anymore, so I found a meeting close to my home in the south side that was a mile down the road, and they had babysitting. And, you know, one time I brought my son to a meeting. Well, actually, I brought him to a lot of evening meetings. My husband worked evenings, so it was kind of hard. And, you know, Mom and Dad are passed away, so we don't have much in the way of babysitting. My sister wasn't going to hang around to babysit much. So I dragged him to meetings. And my son, you know, alcoholic kid. Y'all have seen them in the program. He's just a wild thing, running around the rooms. I didn't control him. He even picked up a blue chip once. It was so cute. But doing laps around Rebos, you know. But yeah, he got his energy out that night. But he, you know, so I dragged him to this meeting, and I remember going to this was my home group for a lot of years, Jaywalkers. Love that group. It's now a committed meeting. I've now go to a Wednesday meeting as a home group. But I remember going to Jaywalkers, and I still had this idea of AA in my brain. I thought AA is where you go to sit there and hold your seat and tell each other not to drink and talk about your problems. I really thought that's what AA was because, you know, IOP sort of looked like that, even though they talked about the solution, but it was run by people who weren't alcoholics, or maybe sometimes there's an alcoholic running it. And I thought that AA was the same thing as that. And nothing against that. It's just different than AA. You know, I remember going to this meeting and thinking I was going to have a chance to spill my guts and tell them my problem and let them make me feel better, because now I don't have alcohol to make me feel better. You know, really my God in practice is how I feel. You know, even though I believe there's a higher power, really what I end up worshiping is making myself feel better and secure. Those are the important things to me. And so that's why I went to these meetings for. And it really ticked me off, even though I heard these great stories and I loved hearing Alex. Alex was chairing the meeting a lot. But these people, they didn't let me talk a lot for whatever reason. I mean, I guess I didn't have a solution to give away, but it was, but I was in that place where I was desperate and willing, and I listened to them, and I believed them for whatever reason. I believed that they were sober and happy at the same time, and I thought, you know, it was kind of a mystery, because I was at that point where I knew I couldn't drink anymore. I mean, I studied alcoholism in nursing school. I took care of alcoholics with the pumpkin yellow face and the ascites, the pregnant-looking belly. And I thought that was an alcoholic, but and I knew I couldn't drink anymore, which really stunk because I never tried a white Russian before. But, you know, I remember coming here, being desperate, and listening. And I thought even if it's white-knuckling it and telling each other not to drink, I was willing to even do that. I am so glad that I came to realize it's not just that. It's not just about white-knuckling it and hoping you don't drink. I mean, I would have been drunk years ago if that's what this was. You know, these people talked about their problem. And even though my life, my drinking might not have looked like theirs, even though I didn't go to jail or treatment, I identified with their thinking and to some degree with how they drank, even though we drank different things. I remember the physical craving. They said things that grabbed my attention. I thought, you know, I might be like him. I might be like her. And that kept me around, the identification. But they didn't stay in the problem, you know? I mean, and not that life was perfect or a pink cloud, but they talked about the solution in their lives, even when life was coming to visit. I mean, these people sometimes went through some hard things, but they were still coming back and they're still thinking of you, you know? All I was capable of thinking of, and some days today, all I'm capable of thinking of, left to my own devices, is me, you know? And these people who you would think were selfish, I mean, you heard their stories, but they were thinking of you. They were helping newcomers, you know? And it got my attention. You know, I remember sometimes, and I love the church, don't get me wrong, but sometimes the church can get into talking about the world going to hell in a handbasket, and you could get all depressed over that. And I'm not knocking churches, please don't. But I've seen that discussion take place, and I got all in the middle of that, and I would get depressed and want to shoot myself. But these people, I saw that they were living life, and life was making sense, and they were happy. And it was very attractive, and I think that kept me around for a while, because they had that glow and that life, and I wanted some of it. And this was even in sobriety my first year. I remember my first year, I didn't drink, but I remember a lot of times when I was calling Val on the phone, you know, with the problem du jour, she'd say, oh, it sounds like untreated alcoholism, politely hang up. And I remember being really ticked off, because I'm thinking, I'm not drinking. What does she mean, untreated alcoholism? What she meant was, even though I was on a step, I wasn't really working on that step. And especially when you're in the fourth step, if you're not riding your fourth step, you start living it. And I know that from personal experience, that first fourth step, and I know it from subsequent fourth steps, you know. Not that you do that all the time, but sometimes I have to ride it if I can't step it away. Because I'm a good liar. I lie to myself. I'm dishonest. I'm dishonest with you. I'm still dishonest at times with my sponsor, and I think I'm telling her the truth. It's the weirdest thing. That's why I need friends in the program, but everything comes to my sponsor. But, you know, I remember talking to her and writing inventory and fifth-stepping with her. There was some kind of plumbing emergency, so I didn't get to finish my fifth step with her. It was kind of funny. She and Alex were going to be getting married the next month, so I got to do part of my fifth step with Marcy. And I don't know, I guess it's a God thing, because the part of my fifth step that I was on, we both have moms who are mentally ill. And instead of looking at it, Marcy just helped me see so many things. Because, you know, alcoholism isn't just drinking. It's about life. And just how I looked at my mom and my family, Marcy just gave me a different lens on it. We even laughed. You know, she had the nerve to laugh at my fifth step when I was sharing the serious stuff with her. But, you know, she helped me laugh at myself. You know, I take myself way too seriously, you know. So, well, I got through that. Got through the last part of my fifth step. Val had me do my sixth and seventh right there at her house. They, out of the big book, some of you might use the big book when you work through the steps. We do it immediately that hour afterwards. Because you know what? I quickly forget where I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. That fourth part of that fourth column that I read to my sponsor. And I had to look at that with God's help after her telling me, you know, some things I left out, especially on the dishonesty part of it. Because, you know, I don't see how I set the ball rolling. I don't see where I'm selfish and self-absorbed and why others react the way they do and how I get the ball. I step on their toes all the time, you know? You know, even though I can be, you know, we're reading last night at our meeting about the alcoholic being the self-centered actor, you know, trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, if only everything would stay put, you know? And it talks about how the self-centered actor will sometimes be mean and egotistical, but sometimes we can be gracious and nice, you know, because I like to manipulate you, and I'll be all understanding. But then if after a period of time that doesn't work, then I turn and I become mean and toxic at you, and because that sometimes works better, but, you know, if I can get you, twist your arm. But, you know, that's how I operate, because I'm fear-driven. And thankfully, even though I can go there today, I don't have to. If I go there today, I have a means of making it right, because the eighth step list was my fourth step list, you know. There's some Val, the way she did it with me. Now there were a couple of people on my list, she said, well, that wasn't a harm, you don't go make amends on a couple of instances. Then there were instances where I didn't think I needed to make an amends, and she said, oh, that's going to be a good amends. And the way I wasn't sure what to say to these folks. My mom and dad were graveside amends. They're passed away by the time, you know, I was doing this process. There was a lady who was human resources director. I was working at Chippenham, and it's interesting. It was when I got sober that I became a major problem at work, you know, because I didn't have my alcohol after work, and it was like, And then so I still haven't found this lady. She has a very common name, and I can't find her. So that's one on my list that I've not done from my first fourth step, but everybody else has done. You know, the tenth step is something that I will practice sometimes with my husband. Sometimes I call Val. Sometimes I'll leave that painfully long voicemail for Val, blah, blah, blah. But the thing is, it gives me a chance to pause and look at what is, usually if I'm starting to feel irritable or fearful, that's a clue that my thinking is wrong. And I don't always even remember the 10th step, but when I remember to do it, I tell somebody about it immediately without gathering allies and yakking about somebody. I just tell them about what's going on with me, and then I immediately turn my mind to somebody that I can help. The way that's looked for me at times when I was at work, I was working for an insurance company, and it wasn't a situation where I could call my sponsor. There was a lady I was just afraid of at work. You know, she was threatening. I was learning this new kind of, I'd never done work comp before. I was a new kid on the block, willing to work hard, real self-conscious about looking stupid, you know, because I'm afraid you won't like me if I'm stupid. And I remember the 10th step, the way I did it that day, I couldn't talk to somebody immediately, but what it occurred to me, God, how can I be helpful to so-and-so? How can I be helpful to her? It just helped me get the eyes off of Lana and Lana's problem and what a victim she is because she wasn't trained properly onto, okay, God, you show me. What do I do next? And, you know, the rest of the day went fine. I'm still learning a little bit more about being a good citizen in my family. I can be very well behaved in these rooms, you know, but practicing these principles in all of our affairs, I'm still learning with my family today, you know. But it must be working in spite of me because my husband and his family, being the good Christian folk, they're wondering if I had to go to AA forever. You know, they get worried about the talk of spirituality in these rooms. But now they're sending people to me or they're asking me questions. So in spite of the selfish, egotistical woman, something is working that they're seeing that's apart from anything I have manufactured. As far as 12 step work, right now I'm just sponsoring one lady. I have been involved with treatment for a long time. I usually would drag myself to treatment. I didn't want to go most nights, but every night I went there, I was so glad I did. Even though the people are on Ativan and they're waking up and they're sleeping, you know, the best time of that meeting is when you go talk to them and you give them your home group and they show up later. You know, and a couple, you don't see many of them call you after, but every now and then they show up and they get sober and they stay sober. I mean, and it wasn't me. I can't make them sober. I can't make me sober. But yet somehow with us being here together, we get sober together. I have no idea how it works, but if I'm willing to do something that goes against my grain, that doesn't make sense to me, that I don't want to do, I don't feel like doing it, but if I just do it anyway, just because the sponsor, my friends in the program say do it, somehow we all end up here and we end up living a reasonably happy life, comfortable in our skin, and we do it together. I mean, it's interesting. Sometimes you feel like you want to give up on AA, especially if you go to a business meeting. We can be pretty well behaved in the meetings, but go to a business meeting and you think, oh, I'm going to give up on AA. But yet somehow we all come together. We love each other, you know, warts and all. You know, I mean, we truly are a group that would not mix. I mean, even in my little home group, and Jaywalkers is still very much like a home group. They're a committed meeting. I mean, people totally different than me, people who would not like me prior to being in the rooms, we're all friends and we really care about each other. I mean, it's an amazing fellowship. You know, I'm just thankful that even though I don't always feel like going out and helping people, when I go do it, that's the precise time I need to do it, you know. Driving 3 hours to pick somebody up and from Goochland or way past Goochland. But, you know, the thing is, it gets me out of self for a little while, you know. And you know, the other stuff, it works out. Because I have this anxiety about not getting all these other things done. And, you know, all these years there are a bunch of projects I didn't get done. You know what? The house hasn't blown up yet, amazingly. But there are just some things that are not important, you know. Because my life, I'm trying to look like my sister in the West End. And I think that that's the right. But you know what? She has a different path than I do. She's helpful to other people in other ways. thanks to this program, I'm starting to see her through a different lens. I had certain ideas for years into sobriety about her, even after I made amends to her. Wrong ideas. And now that I'm starting to sit and listen and look at her, I'm realizing she is not at all what I thought I saw when I was drinking and even in early sobriety. So this program, little by little, takes those whatever it is that's on our eyes that keeps us from seeing the reality around us. And I'm not going to say I feel at peace all the time. I'm not going to say that I'm not fear-driven today at times. But even during those times, life is okay. Even when I'm scared and I'm worried about this or I'm worried about the country, you know, the thing is because, see, I'm God. I want to always fall into that, the lights, the ballet, okay, I've got to influence them. You know, I can't even run my life, for God's sakes. And yet, look at all of us here. We've ended up here sober and alive somehow, in spite of ourselves. And I thank you for being here because I could not do this without you. I'm done. So. Thank you.